Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.
Fueled by Frank and Honest Gourmet Coffee. The perfect blend to kickstart your day. Barista quality coffee available at Centra and Supervalue.
Now, lads, self-help books, let's talk about them. They often sell you a simple plan to follow in order to solve all of your problems. Well, Caroline Foran's new book, Naked, 10 Truths to Change Your Life, actually does the opposite. It confronts the reader with a few doses of reality to try and help you treat yourself a bit better. Caroline, I'm delighted to say, is on the line. How are you, missus? How's it going?
Good, Jen. How are you? Thanks so much for having me. I love the way you described the book there. I'm going to take that and run with that.
Take it. How are you doing? Can we start with something that we've talked about on the show before, imposter syndrome. Why should we not fear it?
Well, really what happens when you feel imposter syndrome is that there's a bit of a gap between the person that you put out there to the world, or maybe the person that you bring to work, and the person that you are privately. So how you feel about yourself privately versus what you put out there. And when we feel that, we feel like maybe we're not cut out for the job. We're trying to be something we're not. We're trying to pretend like we have all the skills that maybe we don't have. And it's not a nice feeling. I think we've all been there. And really, it's something I've managed to get on top of. And the reason, or the way I've managed to get on top of it, is by being willing to embrace my vulnerability and closing that gap. And in order to close that gap, you just need to be a little bit more authentic. So it's really a matter of seeing where that difference is, where that gap is, and doing what you can to close it.
Close it, do you mean improve it? Let's say you're in a job and you're feeling you're not good enough for the things that you're maybe weaker at, maybe try to improve. Is that what you mean?
Well, that's one thing, but also it's just really being comfortable with the gaps in your knowledge. So if you're in a work environment, for example, you don't have to be in a meeting saying, yeah, I have it all figured out, and going home feeling like, oh my God, I have no idea what I'm doing. It's about, I suppose, being willing to say, look, do you know what? I don't know everything here. If you could bring me up to speed on this, that'd be great. Or do you know what? This is what I do know. This is where my strengths are, but here I'm not so sure. It's about, I suppose, being confident to be your most authentic self. And that just dissolves any feeling of imposter syndrome, because you're not pretending to be something that you're not then. You're just being real. And I think it helps people relate to each other better in work. It actually, I think for me anyway, I respect people more when they say, do you know what, I don't know everything. And it helps you actually get better work done, because you work more collaboratively and you get towards a solution much, much faster. So it benefits not only you and how you feel about yourself personally, but also, you know, if you're in a work environment, it actually helps there too.
Do you think it stems from being in school and as kids, and we're told that if we make a mistake, it's bad? I mean, mistakes are good things. It's only when we make mistakes that we grow as people and learn. But I think it's kind of instilled into us from a very early age. You made a mistake, don't make a mistake. Would you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. Like, there's the nurture nature thing going on there with failure or any kind of mistake, where, you know, back in hunter-gatherer times when our brains were evolving, if we made a mistake, our life would be very much at risk. Like, we'd probably get eaten by a lion on, you know, the African plains. So we still have that brain operating very much the same way in a very modern world. And not only that, then we were all, like you say, they were also all brought up to be, you know, have this massive aversion to failure, because if you fail, you'll get a big red F on your exam paper, you'll get put in the bowl corner, you know, you won't get the college course you want, you mightn't get the job you want. So we've been really, really reluctant to not only avoid it, but even the idea of embracing failure is something I think we're only kind of getting around to now. And, you know, if you think about the amount of times you failed in life and how actually that's brought you to where you are now and how necessary that was.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, failure is crap. You know, it feels rubbish. No one's going to relish it. And I wouldn't say, you know, fail and have a party and just be a different person. Of course, it's going to feel bad and you're allowed to wallow in it and be a bit upset for a while. But once you've let the dust settle, it really helps to kind of step back and look for the opportunity in there. Because for me, failure, and this is what I write about in the book, really helps you to kind of course correct, and it kind of sharpens your focus and your senses towards what's working for me, what's not, where are my strengths, where are they not. It just helps you kind of navigate a little bit better. It's quite a blunt tool for helping you get clarity, but it really works.
You're so right when you say, when we look back at failures, because in the moment of that relationship failing, of that job failing, or that gig failing, or whatever, that date, whatever, in the moment it feels, like you said, so awful. But retrospectively, when you look back at it, it's all for the better, and it brings you to a place where you should be in. And they're so important to look at them like that, positively rather than negatively. Now, can I just go bring it to the book? Because it finishes with truth number 10, which I want to talk to you about. There is no end goal. What do you mean by that?
So I was, I suppose, thinking that we live in a very goal-obsessed culture. You know, we're mm-hmm. always striving for 25 years down the line, this is where we want to be. And we tend to lose sight of how that's impacting our lifestyle in the here and now. And we're very focused, and this is a generalization, but, you know, on what it will look like or sound like when we get to that big moment or that promotion or that job. As opposed to what way do you actually want to spend your day now? And so many people are in really high stress environments and they're thinking, oh, you know, it's all worth it because someday you'll get a big payout, or, you know, someday you'll be retired. And then what? Like, you'll be old and gray and, you know, you'll have probably not as much energy as you do now. So for me, I think I was so obsessed myself with the idea of what my career, what success looked like those traditional markers of success around work and money and everything. And really what happened was I was so gung-ho on achieving this goal, this elusive abstract goal, I compromised my well-being in the process, and I started to suffer with really bad anxiety, which is what started me writing these books in the first place. And I suppose I had such a, I learned the hard way to really think, hang on, it's not about what you want to achieve someday, like what about right now today, and reach changing how your goals are informed, and let your lifestyle that you want, to let your well-being inform that goal. Obviously, you know, it's fine to have goals, it's fine to want to achieve certain things, but it's really important to not be so focused on someday, somewhere off in the distant future, and then let the rest of your life go by. It takes the pressure off and it makes you think about really what's important to you right now. So I just think, let go of the idea of an end goal, which sounds, I suppose, a bit, it's not something you hear very often, but it's really liberating when you get there.
Oh my God, it sounds so liberating. Would you say focus on maybe, because I came from a sales background, and every week we'd have to write down goals, work goals, personal goals, on a piece of paper and give it to our boss, and we were so focused on goals and targets for years and years and years. Yeah. It was kind of drilled into me. But you're so right. I mean, goals, long-term goals like that can be dangerous because you don't focus on the here and now, but goals, short-term goals, would you say, daily, weekly are better for you to focus on as a person?
I think like it's far easier to achieve success if you take it in small steps. Even think small, which sounds again quite defeatist, it's just more manageable. It's what your brain is capable of. You know, 1% in every day makes a massive difference. And I have a kind of a, I suppose, an inventory checklist for when you're looking at your goals, to ask yourself to really confront the goals and check in, not with what society deems as, you know, a worthwhile goal, but really what's working for you. Like, what is this goal going to cost you? Like, what do you have to sacrifice in order to achieve this goal? How does it fit in with your other goals? Is it in line with your core values and really what you want from life? Because a lot of the times, if you really look at what you're thinking are your goals, they might be someone else's goals. They might look good on paper. And actually, what really inspired me with that chapter was a conversation I had with a really sound taxi driver one day who was, he was telling me a story about how he had worked. He was a big top dog in a big corporate environment, and he was loaded and, you know, just really successful. Well, that was how he defined success. And now he was driving a taxi and he was kind of apologizing to me for it, that like, oh, like, you know, because of the recession and everything happened, I just took this to fill a gap, and, you know, I'm going to get back there. And I said, and how are you finding it? And he said, well, to be honest, like, I'm happier than I've ever been. I have enough money that I need to take my wife away on holiday. I see my family more. I was working crazy hours. And, you know, he was uncomfortable with the idea that he was happier. He was actually achieving more, and he was more successful in his sense of life and well-being in that. And he was grappling with the idea of what success should look like. And I was like, you actually have it figured out here. You've let go of the idea of an end goal, and you've thought about your daily goals of like, what's important to you is having time with your family, having enough money, obviously, to do what you need to do. And he loved talking to people in the taxi, and he had way less stress and anxiety. And that's something that I think we need to get comfortable with, is the idea of stepping away from what success should look like and really what it means to you.
I love that you said, I didn't expect you to say taxi driver there. I thought you were going to say, I was having this chat with this guru on a mountain in the Himalayas once. And I love that you said taxi driver. I'm all over that. Now, one of the truths I really liked in the book is there's nothing easy about changing your life. Why is it important to realise that before you start to try?
Well, yeah, I think obviously there's so many books out there that claim to, you know, change your life, or you think you'll just share a lovely platitude on Pinterest and you'll be a new person tomorrow, or sharing something, you know, something powerful on Instagram, that you'll be a new person. And we always tend to kind of fall at the first hurdle, especially this time of year. People are taking on new things and then they end up giving up, and then they end up beating themselves up about it. So I wanted, before you look at making any changes, and not that you have to make changes, maybe it's just a change in behavior that's not really working for you, such as maybe you're people pleasing all the time, really looking at the psychology of change and how hard it is and that it's not your fault, but really what's going on in your brain to actually bring about change. Why willpower isn't just something you're just born with. You just, you know, you get it one day and you have it forever. It's something that needs topping up. So I really wanted to dissect why change is so hard, so that we stop, I suppose, blaming ourselves or thinking that we're lazy when we struggle with it, and knowing what to expect. You know, if you're going to try and implement a change, you know, it can take like 66 days for it to become a habit. So you're trying to, I suppose, work with the hardware in your brain and work with yourself as opposed to against yourself. And I guess that's always my main message with everything.
I struggle with willpower, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I struggle.
It's hard, yeah.
I had a goal to be very good this week, and then Susie on the team brings in her home-cooked scones. I was like, get them away from me! I have no willpower. But what are some of the main things that you recommend for getting your willpower in shape to change? Because I think that is something that we all struggle with. And we kind of go, oh, we kind of brush it off. Oh, I've no willpower. I had to have that drink on a Friday. I couldn't do dry January. Oh, I've no willpower. I just shopped online until there was nothing left in my bank account. How can we combat that? Is there any tools or steps that we can do to help that?
I really struggle with that myself. I mean, I'm not great at it, but before you kind of, I suppose, trying to implement willpower, it's to understand the nature of it. And what really helped me was to reframe, you know, thinking of willpower as, and I have to do this, I need to do this, or thinking of it as denying yourself something and reframing it more as I want power, or I will power instead of I won't power, because we tend to think of it in a more negative kind of space. And that's this amazing doctor called Dr. Kelly McGonigal, who I talked to for the book, who really just changed how I think about willpower. Instead of saying I don't want to have this scone right now, I think I want to eat a balanced diet today, you know. And it's just that simple thing just changes how you feel about it in your brain and makes it a little bit more achievable. And then there's, you know, things that help to actually turbo boost your willpower, and it's all the basic stuff, like, you know, if you are knackered, and at the moment I'm not sleeping because I have the world's worst sleeping 5-month-old, so my willpower doesn't stand a chance. Like, if you're not charging those batteries, you know, energy has to come from somewhere. And if you're spending it, if you're burning the candle at both ends, your energy, your willpower needs energy and enthusiasm. So you need to eat, sleep, prioritize the basics. You need to also not take on too much. Like, our brain responds better when we make those tiny increments. And then that becomes something that your brain is used to. So then it's no longer requiring willpower. And then you free up more willpower reserves to do the next little bit. So don't go from 0 to 90 in one. Try and think of it in really small steps. So maybe it's a case of saying, you know, not, I'm not going to ever have sugar again. Maybe I'm going to drop that one, you know, double mocha, which I myself, I'm trying to do. But again, I'm failing because I'm knackered. So thinking small and trying one thing. So I lay it all out in that chapter there, like how to really understand your willpower and make it your ally. And again, it's not something, it's not a personality trait. It's something we can all work on. But it is hard. And even your willpower needs willpower.
Totally. And back to those small goals as well. And they make us feel good when we achieve them. I felt so good saying no to Susie and her scones yesterday. I felt really good about that. Thank you. Thank you. I'm just patting myself on the back here. How is life as a new mum? Has that solved all of your problems?
Oh God, I don't know. Like, everyone's asking me, has it given you a new perspective yet? I haven't had a moment to even think about a new perspective on life. But definitely in terms of like my experience of anxiety, I haven't had any time to feel anxious, I suppose. I'm so consumed with trying to get him sorted. It's been difficult. Like, I was documenting it all on Instagram because I felt the need to just share the realities of it, because I felt so much pressure to, you know, just be in this blissful love bubble and everything be amazing. And the reality was I found it hard, as most mothers do. So I'm doing great now. Like, we're 5 months in, he's weaning, he's a happy little chappy, but like I say, the sleep is a killer, and it's just so hard to be kind to yourself, or it's so hard to get anything done when you're on no sleep. It's just a form of torture.
It is. And I love that you said that. It just keeps popping up on the show. It's like reoccurring on the show day in, day out, just how important sleep is. I think it's something that we definitely need to come back to, because we always talk about diet and exercise and put sleep last, but we had Tricia from Tricia's Transformations on yesterday, and she was talking about the importance of sleep, because it's very hard to get motivated and to do anything if you have a lack of sleep. So I feel your pain not getting any sleep, and I was there once, and it gets easier, but then I heard it gets easier for a little bit, and then it gets harder when they're teenagers and start going out at night, and then you start losing sleep all over again.
Okay.
It's a long way down the road.
Let's go back to
it's a long way. It's a long way. Finally, can I ask you, which I love, just to explain the difference between making your brain feel good and making your ego feel good?
Are you talking about the jealousy chapter?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a tough one to write. All these truths are quite uncomfortable. None of them are particularly easy pills to swallow, but something I've struggled with, and I know other people have too, even if they don't want to admit it, is the feeling that someone else's success will take from yours, and that feeling of jealousy and envy. And it's a sickening feeling, and you feel like a crappy person when, you know, on the inside you're like, oh, my friend just had this massive success and I feel rubbish about myself. What kind of person am I? It's really important to, first of all, give yourself a break and understand where that's coming from. So those feelings of jealousy and envy go back to, again, evolutionary times when, if someone else was successful in, you know, again, go back to that, you know, zone of being attacked by lions, you might, if that person was successful, you might be eaten by that lion. So we have been evolved to react to someone else's success that if they win, therefore I lose. We have this zero sum game mentality. So, and you know, your ego is very much involved in that. So first of all, acknowledge that, allow for that, and then work on turning that envy into, from like a kind of a hostile envy into a benign envy, which is more like taking inspiration from something. And again, like, it leads into social comparison, which is such, you know, a thief of joy and such an anxiety source. And to instead look at yourself as a yardstick. So make your world smaller and bring your focus into you, what you're doing. So for example, you know, if I was to compare myself to someone else who's climbing mountains and doing everything, I think, oh geez, I could never do that. But a couple of years ago, I couldn't even leave my house, my anxiety was so bad. So I'm working with myself there to use my own self as a yardstick for how I'm doing, where I want to be, and measuring, you know, that sense of self-worth and how I'm getting on, as opposed to someone else who is completely separate to me. So yeah, it's really interesting to kind of understand that part of the brain that makes you feel, no, this is mine. I want to keep this for myself.
You said something there, social comparison. It's just the world we live in, the world of Instagram, where we unfortunately are constantly doing it to ourselves. It's very hard not to. Do you have any advice for navigating a healthy online presence, you know, with Instagram and that kind of thing? How do we mind
really
ourselves?
Like, it's a very double-edged sword. You know, social media has been an amazing place for me to be able to not only share stuff around anxiety, but also get comfort from, especially like new mothers saying, you know, you've got this, you'll be fine. But then at the same time, it's like social comparison just, you know, times 1,000, because we shouldn't have access to this many people's lives and all their best bits. You know, we're supposed to be just operating within our small little tribe. So I think you have to get really tough with yourself. And I've had to do it myself, where you really set up proper boundaries around who you're following, what's going on your feed. Be the editor of your own news feed. If something is really taken from your tank and not filling it, get rid of it. No one needs to know. You can mute them, you can just unfollow, and curate a space that's going to serve you as opposed to make you feel bad about yourself.
Great
and
advice.
Then, you know, it's also important to take a step away from it. So like, you can even set up limits on the amount of time you use you know, your social media apps during the day. It's we're never going to not have this tendency towards social comparison. It's built into us, so you just need to work around it and try and set up some boundaries, I think.
Very, very good advice. Listen, I won't keep you any longer with your 5-month-old. Caroline Forn's new book, Naked, The 10 Truths to Change Your Life, is out now. Caroline, thank you so much for joining me on the show, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you so much, Jen. It was a pleasure chatting to you.
Bye. Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.